This week on The Score, where were you in 1979? Do you remember the hit movie Breaking Away? What does it take to win a Nobel Peace Prize? Can one woman take on the education establishment and win? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Last weekend was the Virginia Film Festival in Charlottesville. I had an opportunity to interview several filmmakers about their work. Let's start with actor Dennis Christopher, who had the lead role in the 1979 Oscar-winning movie Breaking Away. He came to the film festival to celebrate its 40th anniversary, and I talked to him about his life and career and his co-stars. Here's Dennis Christopher.
I understand that you just visited Monticello. Was that your first visit to Thomas Jefferson's home?
And not my last either.
What was it like?
Well, it's magnificent. It's really magnificent. It's hard to describe. I had no idea he was so ingenious. The inventions, the way the house is laid out, it's tremendous. From the oven that he had with the stovetops, practically, to the ice storage chambers. I mean, I've seen a lot of vintage furniture and vintage rooms, but to see the inner workings of the house for me was really fascinating. And to see how everything was laid out, he was a very organized man, apparently.
Yeah, we're talking with Dennis Christopher at the Virginia Film Festival. You're here to celebrate the 40th anniversary of your film, Breaking Away. But I'd like to talk a little bit about your earlier career. I was looking at your IMDb page, and I noticed that your first credit when you were about 12 years old was on the Time Tunnel. It's not true?
Yes. I hate to take your time up on this podcast debunking that. But, yeah, I don't know who that credit belongs to.
Oh, really? Okay.
Is it as Merlin or something like
right,
that?
Right, right.
And I have no idea.
It's on your Wikipedia page, too. That needs to be corrected.
I suppose so.
Well, I can edit that part up.
Oh, please. Oh, I wish you could edit it out of Wikipedia.
I probably can.
Please.
Well, let's go back then.
It keeps appearing, and I don't know why they do that, because I did not work when I was 12. I became an emancipated minor when I was 17, and that's when I began my professional. That's when I began searching for acting jobs that would pay.
Exactly.
My career. But more than likely, I was a busboy or unloaded trucks or stuff like that for years before I got my first part.
What was your first paying acting role? Was it on stage, on television?
It was on stage. I did a lot of stuff back east in regional things and as a child actor and stuff like that. But the first professional job was in Los Angeles, really, and it was a horror film called Blood and Lace with the great Gloria Graham.
Ah.
And
an Oscar winner.
Yeah, and we became friends, and it was it's a horror movie, a bunch of young people being in an orphanage, being terrorized by this older, cruel crone, and, you know, it was that kind of a thing. And I don't think any of the kids had any idea the power and the greatness of this actress that they were working with, but I've always been into classic films, and I knew immediately who she was and made a beeline to sit right next to her at lunch and talked every day with her and actually had a very beautiful run-in with her 20 years later, right before she went back to England and actually ended up dying.
And that, of course, became a film in itself.
When she came out to Los Angeles, during that film, when she came out to Los Angeles with her lover in tow, is when I ran into her again years later, and now I was a star. And she was like, Dennis. And I said, Gloria. And she said, look what happened to you. I said, I know. And we went to the bar at the Beverly Hills Hotel and had a drink and caught up with each other.
Well, I'm curious, when you were working with her on that first film, what did you learn from a veteran actress like yourself?
I just listened to everything she had to say. I mean, I didn't know about film acting. I knew about film, but not about film acting, because all my experience was stage. Before, mostly musical comedies. I just listened. The stories that she told about some of her fellow actors and leading men, she just worked with some of the greats. And I just listened to her talking about Bogart and all the film noirs that she was in. And she was just a lovely woman. And she was very young at heart. She was just great. She was just great.
As I mentioned, we're here because you are at a screening of Breaking Away, celebrating its 40th anniversary.
Yes.
And in that film, you co-starred with Paul Dooley.
Yes.
And you did three shows with him, two movies and a TV show. What was it like working with him? Because he's all over the screen.
Yes. Well, ever since Breaking Away, he's kind of become America's dad in movies, 16 Candles, and just all the work that he's done after that, playing the dad. But we were father and son for those three projects that you mentioned, and yet a fourth project where he was a priest and I would call him father all the time. So it was almost four times we were father and son. But we just kept getting cast like that, luckily. We worked for Robert Altman in a wedding, and then that led to Breaking Away, and we did a CSI and a bunch of things together.
Yeah, let's talk about Breaking Away.
Yes.
That was a little film. I mean, it wasn't a big blockbuster like Jaws or Star Wars, which are contemporaries to that film. Did you expect it to become such a breakaway hit?
No, not at all. It really was my first lead role going in. I was in another picture called California Dreaming that was more of an ensemble piece. But when they got done cutting it, they cut it around my character. So it ended up being the lead. But I didn't know that. Breaking Away was very consuming for me. I was in nearly every shot. I wasn't an athletic young man, so the bike stuff was a challenge for me. And then getting the spirit of that boy was really important for me, that he would still be eccentric and kooky enough to have the audacity to be following these big dreams in this little town. But at the same time, he had to be a cutter. He had to be a townie. A kid that was born there that didn't have the advantages of all the other college students there. And he couldn't be so unusual that he wasn't friends with these three other guys. You know, they were very, very tight. As they say in the movie, they wanted to waste the rest of their lives together. But what's unique about this movie, I find, given to us by two immigrants, Peter Yates was from England, and Steve Cesic is from a Yugoslavian country. And their perspective of the film, of life in America, is different. And I think it caught the audience off guard, because it was just done with such care and such love that they had for the country and for the people of America. It's a very, very American film. And while it's entertaining and one of the best sports movies ever, it still has an important message about class, mm-hmm. about relationship between fathers and sons, relationships between husband and wife. There's so many subtle lessons in this movie that you don't even have to know you're learning something. You can just cheer for the racing and be completely entertained by the movie, but you're also getting another message about things that are even relevant today.
You mentioned the relationship between husband and wife. We talked about Paul Dooley playing your father, but the great Barbara Barry was your mother.
Oh, I was so honored to be on screen with Barbara Barry.
She had such a great Broadway career.
Her first movie she was nominated for an Oscar for.
Oh, I didn't know
One
that.
Potato, Two Potato, and one of the first interracial relationships on film.
Yeah, it's amazing. What was it like working with her?
Oh, she's just fantastic. Both of them were great. I was very impressed that Barbara was going to be in it. Paul was another friend. Dennis Quaid was a good friend of mine before mm-hmm. that as well. But for me, the two people that knocked me out to meet in that movie were Jackie Earle Haley and Barbara Barry. I've been following Jackie's career since Day of the Locust. It wasn't even Bad News Bears that put me over the top with him. It was Day of the Locust. So it was funny. The casting of this movie is the key to it, I think. Mm-hmm. Aside from the script, because many things changed in the script because of the casting. And
including your own character.
Very much so. And I thought that was one of Peter Yates' genius moves, is he just casts the right people in this movie. And we didn't even know we were the right people at the time. I mean, I wasn't athletic.
Mm-hmm.
They had called me in because they saw me in an Altman film, and they wrote the part, the last couple drafts of the movie, they had me in mind when they wrote the part of Cyril. And it was just by a fluke that I ended up playing the character I did play, because the guy that was supposed to audition for that part was late, so they asked me to read both roles. And they looked at me differently when I started doing that, and then, I don't know, the next day I was told I was playing Dave and not Cyril. At that time, we didn't know who the leads were.
Mm-hmm.
We just thought it was the whole movie was about just these four guys.
So this is a story of serendipity.
In many ways, in many ways. I missed the first 2 weeks of rehearsal and week of shooting because I was on another movie that they wouldn't let me go from. And I ended up finding out later that between Peter Yates and my agent, they had lied to 20th Century Fox, pretending that I could be there at any day, and they were just still waiting as long as they could to get me there. And the studio was very adamant about, go with your next choice, go with your next choice. And Peter just kept hemming and hawing and did long enough so I could make it down there, because he had some idea about me that I didn't even have yet.
Amazing. Well, we need to wrap this up, so I'd just like to find out, what are you working on now? What is Dennis Christopher doing 40 years after Breaking Away?
A savoring life, having a really good time. I just got married a couple of years ago, which has been a new journey for me at this late in life. As far professionally, I'm on a series that they stream. It's called Graves. We've done about 3 years of it. I did 1 year of it. In the arc of my storyline that may come back again with Nick Nolte.
Uh-huh.
This was this is a series on Epics called Graves, G-R-A-V-E-S, and it's a story about an ex-president and played by Nick Nolte.
Well, we'll have to link to that on BearingDrift.com. I'm looking forward to the screening tonight.
Also, I have an anniversary next year.
Oh, really?
Of quite a different movie. The movie I did after Breaking Away is called Fade to Black.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a 40th anniversary next year.
And then a year from then is the 40th anniversary of Chariots of Fire.
Well, there's that, too.
You're going to be really busy on the festival
it's
circuit.
It's funny. As you get older, sometimes you get more busy.
But you've been in 3 Academy Award-nominated movies. All of them won a award for Best Screenplay. That's quite an accomplishment.
Oh, you mean Django Unchained and Chariots of Fire?
And Breaking Away.
Yeah. Oh, I've been very blessed to work with some of the best directors that have been my personal favorites, and I've just been very lucky enough to be able to be in their pictures. I've been very blessed.
Well, I'm glad you were able to make it here to the Virginia Film Festival
I'm glad that the film festival invited us for this anniversary. I'm grateful to them for opening the movie up to fathers that can now bring their sons and daughters.
That's great. Dennis Christopher, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bearing Drift. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
One of the new films that screened at the Virginia Film Festival was a documentary called We Believe in Dinosaurs, which chronicles the building of the Ark Encounter, a sort of theme park in Kentucky. I spoke to the co-directors, Monica Long Ross and Clayton Brown.
Do you think it was an underestimate when P.T. Barnum said there's a sucker born every minute?
I don't know about that. I think that we believe what we believe.
And here's your producing partner. Could you give me your name, please?
Clayton Brown.
A more important question is, the subjects of your film, the Ark Encounter, creationists, they drive cars, they use computers, they use modern technology to build their facilities, and yet they reject science and the scientific method. Is this really a movie about cognitive dissonance?
I would answer that in two ways. One, they do not reject science. They embrace cheerfully. If you ask them, they say, we love science, because they're used to that criticism that they reject science. They say, we absolutely love science. We our technology, our cell phones and satellites and all that, so they enthusiastically embrace science. But yes, cognitive dissonance, in especially when you think about those on staff, PhD scientists, that have to go through a program. One of them is from Harvard. He had to get a degree in science from Harvard while maintaining this notion that most of what mainstream science says is false, and that he and his group alone know the real truth. And so, as you may have remembered when David in the film said, every creationist has a little guy in their head that says, okay, you can listen to this, and then closes the shutter, nope, we can't listen to this. So there's a real strong filter that happens, and I think absolutely that it's got to create some cognitive dissonance.
But they didn't build a museum because they didn't like science. They built a museum because they wanted to headlight their science for everyone else and explain it. So they call it creation science. So this, what we term science, what they term science, could be quite different, but to say they don't like science is not true.
It's just that they have a different idea of what science is.
Exactly. The definition of science is quite different.
They think science is a form of religion, as Ken Ham said in that clip at the end of the film.
Right. It's religion versus religion.
And they do use the Bible as a scientific text from which they extrapolate ideas.
How did you come across the idea for this movie? Obviously, you had to know what was going on before it happened in order to get access to everything that we saw in the film. Where did the genesis of this project come from?
Well, we, as I mentioned in the Q&A, this is our third film together, and we make documentaries about the intersection of science and culture, about America's strange relationship with science. So, as we made our first two films, we knew that this was kind of bubbling in the background.
Well, in fact, the Dover court case was going on, trying to get intelligent design into the curriculum in Dover, Pennsylvania. And that was going on when we were making our very first films, The Atom Smashers.
So we decided for this third film, we really wanted to get at that. And so we learned about the Creation Museum, and just fortuitously, right as they were about to begin this very large project. And so we thought, that's the perfect hook to hang a story on, because it's got great chronology and there's something physical that will be there. So that's when we sort of started making contact to see if we could go into their world and take a look at what they're doing.
And as you said, they're very open in dealing with secular journalists.
Absolutely.
They are not afraid of being mocked.
I think they've moved beyond that. I think that what they're saying is advertising and reaching out to the public, especially if you're going to build something like a theme park where you got to have people paying tickets. They have to step out of that and say, we want people to come, so you have your beliefs, we have ours, you ask about ours, and we're going to tell you.
And
I was just going to say, they definitely don't have the fear of being mocked. In fact, they position themselves as the David against the Goliath. So when they do get persecuted or made fun of or whatever it is, those are battle scars that they're proud to overcome.
And your approach in this film was to treat them with respect and dignity.
Yes.
And so they come out much better because of that. And when they say something that's really stupid, the audience laughs, but they don't realize they're saying something really stupid.
They don't see it as stupid.
No, they don't.
Yeah, and I hate to use the word stupid, even though it's something that we, you know, as far as we know, it's completely wrong, and it sounds bizarre. But when it's what someone believes so deeply as their core, it's tough to call it stupid without calling them stupid.
Right, right. It's more ignorance than stupidity.
Or a willful disbelief of something that is very clearly established.
It also lets the audience off the hook. If they can say, well, it's just this dumb group in Kentucky that's doing this, then they can say, we don't have to worry about it. But that's not true. These people are intelligent, they're very savvy, they're very media savvy, and they're getting their message out. So to use words like dumb or stupid just doesn't answer what's happening here. And some of these people, believers in creationism, are in the White House right now. So we can't. It makes the problem very small if you're going to call people names. And this is a very big problem.
There's a sophistication behind the movement.
Absolutely.
That many people would not expect.
Exactly.
Last question, what's the distribution plan for this movie? Where will people be able to see it?
It's being distributed by a company called 1091, and on November 19th it will be available on iTunes and Google Play and other places
iTunes
like that.
iTunes doesn't exist now,
well,
so
yeah,
probably Apple Video.
TV or whatever they call it now, where you can pay it probably $2 and rent it. And then on February 17th it will be on Independent Lens, the PBS Nationally Independent Lens.
Okay.
And then maybe after that it may be available somewhere, but so far that's our distribution.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it on TV. Thank you both for your comments today. It's a wonderful film.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Although it did not play at the Virginia Film Festival, a new movie called Miss Virginia is getting some buzz. It's the first narrative feature film from the Moving Picture Institute. The Score's film critic, Tim Halsey, has a review.
As conservative movie making goes, the new film Miss Virginia is squarely in the middle of the pack. It's not atrocious or incompetent like a Dinesh D'Souza documentary, but it doesn't connect with its audience like a solid evangelical movie can either. Now available on streaming video, Miss Virginia is the first full-length narrative feature from the conservative-funded Moving Picture Institute, and it tells the story of Virginia Walden Ford, an African-American school choice activist who in 2003 successfully lobbied Congress to institute a scholarship program so that low-income children in Washington, D.C. could attend private schools. The story is a rousing populist yarn worthy of Frank Capra if Capra had thought of setting one of his films on the mean streets of Southeast D.C. Unfortunately, the script by Aaron O'Connor can't quite keep its focus on either the main character or the main story, frequently becoming distracted with Capitol Hill politics, or even worse, with boys-in-the-hood gangster cliches. The film is trite, sometimes even patronizing to African-American audiences. But at its best, which is often, Miss Virginia shows a resilient, charismatic African-American woman and community who rise above the failed policies, urban blight, and social inertia that contrive to keep them in poverty and despair. Director R.J. Daniel Hanna has an excellent cast to work with, starting with Emmy-winning actress Uzo Aduba in the title role. Miss Aduba gives a powerful, graceful, thoroughly moving performance that stresses her character's strength and dignity through hardships and triumphs. The film wisely stresses Miss Virginia's role as a single mother. In the film, she becomes an advocate for school choice, not because of any existing political convictions, but because she desperately wants to pull her bright son out of his failing public school into a learning environment where he can thrive. This places her in the crosshairs of D.C.'s liberal congresswoman, played with diva-like gusto by Onjanue Ellis. Obviously modeled on Eleanor Holmes Norton, Ms. Ellis' character is a two-dimensional caricature of condescending liberal politicians, congratulating herself on high-dollar campaign contributions while keeping the city's dysfunctional status quo firmly in place. Ms. Ellis is always tremendous fun to watch, whether projecting unctuous sympathy during city council meetings or throwing shade at Miss Virginia. But she's strictly the villain in this melodrama, and her role is underwritten and entirely predictable. Also predictable, though much less amusing, is the film's hackneyed evocation of Southeast D.C., complete with crack mothers wandering the streets, menacing drug dealers who threaten the main character, and even a gratuitous drive-by shooting. It's practically a checklist of how clueless white people believe African Americans live. I should add that all this is part of a subplot involving Miss Virginia's son, James, winningly played by Niles Finch, but in a poorly conceived role that makes his character little more than a passive receptacle for victimhood. Although there's potentially a good deal of pathos in the idea that Miss Virginia's community activism might inflict an unseen toll on her family, the film doesn't bother to develop it. By the end of Miss Virginia, the political triumph of school choice has magically healed broken families, provided long-awaited balm for wounded communities, and all but made the front yards of Southeast D.C. well-manicured and green again. For those who are skeptical about the power of government to do these things, it's a feel-good ending that feels much too good to be true. The weakest link in Miss Virginia is well-known film and television actor Matthew Modine, who plays Cliff Williams, a fictional white Midwestern congressman. This political conservative begins as an object of Miss Virginia's distrust, yet forms a professional bond with her over their shared interest in school choice. Modine is supposed to play one of the good guys here, but he seems to suck the air out of the room whenever he appears on screen, and even the most diehard Hollywood liberal would be hard-pressed to create a conservative character as deeply loathsome and obnoxious as his. One scene in which he taunts the African-American D.C. representative over her non-voting status is meant to be uplifting, I suspect, but comes across as cruelly racist mockery. Too much of Miss Virginia shares the same tone-deaf quality. It celebrates the triumph of conservative policy instead of the triumph of people, and as such, it's likely to lose African-Americans who should have comprised much of the film's potential audience. Still, while watching Miss Virginia, I often had the sense that there was a very good film inside this one struggling to get out. I doubt it will make any converts to school choice, but even skeptics on the issue may find Uso Aduba's performance reason enough to give Miss Virginia an iTunes rental. For my own part, I felt that the heart of Miss Virginia was in the right place, even if its script had trouble getting there.
When The Score returns, we'll hear from the subject and executive producer of Miss Virginia, and from two other filmmakers who brought their work to the Virginia Film Festival. The Score will be right back, so don't wander too far.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. Earlier in the show, Tim Halsey reviewed the new film Miss Virginia. Now we get to hear from Miss Virginia herself, Virginia Walden Ford. I spoke to her by telephone on Wednesday.
We're talking today with Virginia Walden Ford, who is both the executive producer and the subject of a new movie called Miss Virginia. So I'd like to ask you first, what is the story told in this movie, and how does it relate to your own life?
Well, the story that's told in the movie is about a parent who had great concern for what was happening to her son in the community that they lived in. It was a low-income community, lots of children, a lot of single mothers, but a lot of bad stuff. And so drug dealers and crime were rampant in that community. And how she was so concerned about her child that she was trying to figure out a way to save him, and found that one of the things she could do was get other parents together to advocate for him, for other parents to advocate for their children. And so it takes you on the journey that she took in finding out how to do that. And one of the things was going to Congress, because this happened in Washington, D.C., going to Congress and talking to members of Congress about how can we make things better for our children? How can they have access to quality education? And one thing she thought of was possibly having access to private schools. You know, poor people don't have options. You know, you end up going to the school they tell you to go to, or your children going to the school they tell you to go to, because you can't move into a better neighborhood. You don't have the money for private schools. And so her journey was to make sure that there were other kinds of options, and in this case, a scholarship program that would allow kids to go to schools that would better meet their needs. How it relates, it's my story, but it's also a story for 100,000 other parents. But it is my story, and I'm really humbled and pleased that my story could be a beacon for other parents' stories who have gone through similar kinds of things.
And when you talk about the hundreds of thousands of other parents, it's not just in Washington, D.C., but in places like Cleveland and Milwaukee and Florida, where these types of scholarship programs have sprouted up. And you were part of that movement.
Absolutely. You know, we were very fortunate in that when our scholarship program was advocated for, when we fought for our scholarship program in the early 2000s, there were a lot of other parents around the country that were doing the same thing. And we encouraged each other. I mean, you know, you don't think that there's so many parents and you can encourage it, but their stories helped inspire me. You know, Cleveland, Milwaukee, those parents' stories gave us a lot of courage and made us feel like if they can do it, we can do it. And I hope parents learned if I could do it, they could do it. So, it became something that, you know, was passed from city to city, from urban centers to rural communities, that parents' voices could change how kids were served educationally in this country.
And your personal story as a pioneer or path setter did not begin in the late 1990s in Washington, D.C. You were one of the first students to integrate the public schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. And could you tell me a little bit about what that experience was like?
Well, 10 years after, everybody knows the Little Rock Nine story and how they tried to integrate schools and went through so much chaos and turmoil. Well, 10 years later, there was still needing to be a continuation of desegregating schools in Little Rock. And we took a group of about 135 kids into Central, which had been the original school that had been talked about with the Little Rock Nine, to continue the desegregation process in Little Rock. And it was eye-opening for me. I was 14, and I wanted to go to the black high school where my older sister went. But we were encouraged to go to Central. Actually, my daddy and mama didn't give me a choice. They said, you're going to Central, and you're going to see how important it is to be in an environment that has better able to get better materials, books, whatever was available, whatever made Central a quality school. You can take advantage of that now. So it wasn't easy. It was hard for us. There were thousands of kids in Central, and we were kind of a drop in the bucket, and everybody didn't still, after 10 years, didn't want us there and let it be known. And so we had to deal with those kinds of things. But, all in all, it was a great experience. I mean, I remember seeing their school library for the first time, and I'm a reader, and I just thought, oh, this is just amazing. And I think it was then that I realized what this beautiful school with all this wonderful material how it could help me. But it wasn't easy for us. I mean, I think all over the country, schools were they were continuing the desegregation process, and black kids were going into schools and having to, find their way. And so we were no different from anybody else. We wanted to be where we wanted to be, and our parents saw how important it was for us to continue to do this. I have younger siblings, so that was, the one thing that my parent always said to me, my dad, you have younger siblings, and they're going to look at what you did, and they're going to make choices based on how their older siblings fared,
Yes. Did your experience as a teenager prepare you for your fight against the educational establishment in the late 1990s, early 2000s?
Absolutely. It made me strong, I mean, like I said, there were people who still didn't want us in schools, in traditional public schools that had been predominantly white. And so we had to be tough and strong, and we had to make sure that we did things in a way that would eventually be really important to our siblings. And so in going into being an activist for my own children, I had to think back about what my dad said about my siblings. And if I don't fight, or if we didn't fight when we were teenagers, if I don't fight as a parent, who will fight for my child?
That's an important question. I'd like to switch gears just a bit because we don't have much time left. I'd like to find out how your personal story ended up on the big screen. How did the movie Miss Virginia get made?
One of the things is we were in Washington, D.C., and it was a federal program that was being advocated for, so I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. But I think that our group of parents and myself, humbly as their leader, had a lot to say. And we said it publicly, and I think that people noticed that it was any parent kind of story, you know, and that parents all over the country could look at D.C. and look at the parents in D.C. and really make a difference. And so that's what I think. You could have never told us that anybody would have cared about our story 15 years ago, but they did care about our story because it was just like many other stories being told. But I'm sure that being in D.C., being in the public eye, really helped the people that really wanted to tell the story, who ultimately told the story, look at this as an important historical story. And it was. The parents were amazing, and it is an important story. But it's everybody's story. All theirs, the urban parents, everybody, rural parents. So
as executive, go ahead.
I just said D.C., I'm sure, was important.
Absolutely. Sort of the center of the universe these days. But as executive producer, how much did you have to do with the actual filmmaking process, like choosing the director, the screenwriter, the members of the cast? What was your role in the making of the movie?
You know, they talked to me every step of the way. They were amazing in how they wanted this to be told accurately and fairly. And the screenwriter actually ended up being somebody that I talked to about all these other kinds of processes, who is this wonderful, heartfelt woman who took hundreds of hours of, she and I just having conversations and wrote this amazing script. But I was I was happily involved every step of the way. They called me all the time. They, made sure that I knew what was going on. They made sure that everything was going to be done in a way that was going to make all of us proud, and it has. I spent time with Uzo Aduba when she was first brought on board, and that was perfect. I mean, she was perfect. And so I was involved a lot. I mean, I can only say that. And it was great for me because I felt ownership for the story, you know. And a lot, I know sometimes when stories are made about somebody's life, they don't feel that ownership. I do. You know, I feel this is our story. This is beautiful and inspiring and wonderful. And that's because MPI kept me constantly involved.
Well, that's a great endorsement. Just to close out, can you tell me where people can see Miss Virginia? Is it in theaters?
Well, right now,
go ahead.
Well, it's in limited theaters. It's in limited theaters, and if you go to Miss Virginia movie, the official website for the movie, they'll give you the list. But you can also get it on Amazon or iTunes or many of the other video on demand outlets. I mean, hundreds of them. And I urge people to see it. I've watched it 10 times.
Well, I will be sure to put a link to that information on our website on bearingdrift.com. And I'm sorry we have to close out now, but Virginia Walden Ford, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bearing Drift. I'm looking forward to seeing your story on the screen.
Thank you for having me.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at bearingdrift.com.
Let's go back to the Virginia Film Festival, where I saw a new documentary about former Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, who received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to end his country's long civil war. I talked to Patty Sellers, one of the film's producers, about how this project came about.
Patty Sellers, producer of Port of Destiny, which is about the conflict in Colombia and President Santos winning the Nobel Prize. You're also a graduate of the University of Virginia. You went on to a career in journalism. How did UVA prepare you for both journalism and making a film like this?
Well, I graduated in 1982. I was an English major. I believe strongly in liberal arts education. I probably, had Thomas Jefferson not established this rule that he wanted to provide students a liberal arts education, I might have chosen to major in journalism. but I couldn't because there's no journalism major at UVA. So I wanted to write about the arts coming out of college, and I couldn't find a job, and I found a job at a startup business newspaper outside Washington in Northern Virginia. Found I loved business, and then 2 years later, I went to Fortune magazine.
And that's a great place to land. Let's talk about Port of Destiny. How did this project come into your hands?
Well, we, a colleague of mine from Fortune, Nina Easton, who was the top Washington editor at Fortune, she and I stepped away from writing for the magazine and started a company called Sellers Easton Media a few years ago, telling stories of leadership and impact. President Juan Manuel Santos, who was an 8-year, two-term president of Colombia, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2016, was leaving office in 2018. His supporters wanted a film about his dramatic story of settling with the FARC rebels and bringing peace to Colombia after over a half century. We did a short film for him, and then we had so much fantastic access and great material. We bought all the raw footage for a dollar, and we made our own independent film that did not require his approval, and so what we showed at the Virginia Film Festival was an independent hour-long film about his path to peace.
And this is appearing in other film festivals as well. Where else have people seen it?
It has been at the Calabasas Film Festival outside of Los Angeles. It's been at the Tucson Film Festival. It has been shown at Oxford, at the Harvard Kennedy School, at Georgetown. Some of these screenings have been with President Santos himself and an interview afterwards.
Now, the film acknowledges that the agreement that President Santos came to with the FARC was fragile. There's a great line from Tony Blair in the film where he says, the agreement is just the beginning. And the president acknowledged that this could take decades to take root. Right now, the agreement seems to be falling apart. How do you think this film might help in maintaining the stability of the peace agreement?
This film is about a moment in time. This film shows that one man can make a difference. What is happening now in Colombia, where Colombia is under the leadership of a new president who is Santos's opponent, again showing that one man can make a difference. Peace is fragile. President Santos, the current president of Colombia, is not a supporter of the peace deal, so a lot of the conditions are not being followed. We just don't know yet what the long-term situation in Colombia will be.
Where is this project going now? Do you expect any distribution so it could perhaps be nominated for an Academy Award?
We are trying to get distribution. We've had a couple of offers, but not the kind of offers we want. And there is interest right now by a major Hollywood studio in optioning it for a feature film. It's a very dramatic story, and we'll see. We have a big meeting about that next week.
This would make a great feature film narrative with, you know, Antonio Banderas playing President Santos.
Antonio Banderas is the guy I have in mind as well.
Well, I guess we're thinking alike. Patty Sellers, thank you for your time today. I appreciate your joining us on The Score from Bering Drift, and I wish you good luck in forwarding this film to the public.
Thank you so much. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
If you have seen the television shows Fresh Off the Boat or Dear White People, you may have seen the work of writer and director Stephen J. Kung, who grew up in Virginia Beach and graduated from UVA. We had a brief conversation about writing for television.
Okay, just a few questions.
Yes.
I was looking at IMDb and your Wikipedia entry, and your career seems to have taken some unusual turns. You
yes.
have a degree in international relations from the University of Virginia, is that right?
Yeah, foreign affairs, and I concentrated on human rights, and Michael Smith was my thesis advisor.
And you know, my degrees from Georgetown and the LSE are also in international
okay,
relations.
Okay, very, yes.
But how did UVA prepare you for what you're doing now?
I would say, you know, a good liberal arts education is necessary to learn how to think, and it gave me a capacity for empathy, you know, and especially when you study human rights. And so, but it also gives you a righteous anger about it. And so I feel like when I've been working on shows that have some social justice element, and I gravitate towards them. So, like, Dear White People certainly has that. Mm-hmm. Falling for Angels has that. And then, like, stories about people on the intersections or on the margins. So, you know, it just sort of shapes the way you see the world. And it, I pick and choose my projects because of who I am from that training.
When did you discover that you had a facility for writing screenplays?
I didn't really know I could do it until I did it. And so I was interning and PAing around for documentaries in D.C., and I decided I really wanted to get my hands on the camera and direct and write as well. And so I basically hit up all the alumni I knew, asked them about it, and then applied to film school because I really wanted to move to L.A., which is where the action was. And so I just learned the old-fashioned way through school, and I did well in class, and that's how I learned I could write.
In the Q&A we just saw, you talked a little bit about being in the writer's room for Dear White People. What's it like to be dropped into a writer's room with a bunch of people who've been working together for a long time, and you're the new guy?
Well, actually, I started on season one, and so we were all new to it, except Justin, you know, so we all created the show together, and it's been such a supportive experience, and like I feel like my voice as the Asian in the room is supported because they want to recognize all minority experiences. And so this past season, they've brought the Asian character back. They've given her a small arc. And so it's really nice to be in a supportive environment like
and,
that.
And your next credit debuts tomorrow night, Fresh Off the Boat,
yes.
A popular ABC TV series, although it may not be so popular because it moved from Tuesday to Friday.
Which yes, is, yes, that's
but,
true.
So what was that experience like?
It was a very supportive experience as well because it was my first time directing an episode of television, like network television. Mm-hmm. So this was the big leagues, and they the crew knew it, and I'd shadowed on the show before, and I was just I treated it as like being at a cocktail party and being the host and like just having to please everyone. Because they're the family. That's where you feel like you're truly the outsider. But because they all knew it was my first time and they all wanted to see me succeed, they treated me as like I was family. And it meant a lot to me because I'm the first Taiwanese American guy to direct a show about Taiwanese American guys. So like, So I was attracted to that show from the start, and I'm so glad that it turned out well.
Yeah, I like that show. It's interesting that it's one of the few primetime television series with an Asian-American cast.
Yeah.
And what do you think is the future of Asian-American television for a broad audience?
I feel like Fresh Off the Boat is sort of the Cosby show for Asian Americans, right? Once it became a big hit, like Fresh Off the Boat already went into syndication, hopefully that will open the door for a lot more shows about other types of Asian Americans, for other Asian American experiences. So I feel like even though it's a very mainstream show on a very mainstream network, that has its time and place, and it's going to open the floodgates for many more stories.
Well, Stephen J. Kung, thank you for coming to the Virginia Film Festival, and I appreciate you joining us on The Score from Bearing Drift.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It feels like a homecoming. Thank you for interviewing me.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
In our From the Archives segment this week, we return to the topic of school choice, the issue that animates Miss Virginia. In this conversation from 2011, I asked the Heritage Foundation's Lindsay Burke about school choice and how it works.
How did you get interested in school choice issues?
You know, that's a great question, actually. I think that it's so evident that the monopoly public school system is failing, I would say, millions of kids every year who are confined to their schools based on their parents' zip code. I mean, to me, it just seems like it's antithetical to the way we run the rest of our country. And in no other aspect of our lives do we accept this kind of monopoly. You know, we don't accept it in higher ed. We don't even accept it in preschool for the most part. But for some reason, K-12 education, we've decided choice is not good enough. And, you know, it's just mind-boggling to me, and I think that's what really drove my interest up originally. I mean, can you imagine if we told a college student that receives a federal subsidy, a student loan to attend college, sorry, you can't attend UVA, you have to go to Virginia Tech. People would be up in arms about that, and yet that's how our K-12 system operates. I think it's maddening.
Mm-hmm. People are likely going to be familiar with the idea of vouchers or tuition tax credits or even charter schools. What are some of the other school choice innovations that are happening today that maybe my readers would not have heard about?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most exciting innovations is education savings accounts, which are happening in Arizona. Arizona just enacted this last year, and so the first cohort of students are benefiting from ed savings accounts. And right now it's solely special needs children that have access to this, but I think there are a few little rumblings about expanding it to more children, children in particular who are in DNF schools, so we'll see if that plays out this year. But basically the way it works is if you're a parent of a special needs child and you feel that the public system isn't meeting your needs, you can take the child out of the public system and get 90% of what the school would have spent deposited in your ESA. And you can then use that to write a check for private school tuition, for a little bit of online learning, a little bit of homeschooling, special ed services. So you can really diversify how you spend your share of education dollars. And I think, and you can even save it year to year, use it for higher ed. And so I think when we think through what our education system will look like 10 to 20 years from now, it's going to be much more, there will be far more online learning involved. And I think being able to rewrite funding the way Arizona has done it to help facilitate this move toward online learning and really create a customized education system for children, I certainly think it's the direction in which school choice is going, and it's one of the most innovative policies we've seen to date.
What was your reaction to the education proposals that the president made in his State of the Union address?
Typical, I think. You know, it's pretty incredible to hear the president say that he basically thinks states should require students to stay in high school until they graduate, or else what? You know, I mean, so that was a pretty incredible thing to say. We already have many of these laws on the books at the state level that say students have to remain in school until they're 18 or until they graduate. So, you know, I mean, it was just an odd policy recommendation, and I don't think anyone was really expecting to hear that. But the other stuff that we heard, you know, is the usual calls for increasing federal spending for education. And, you know, we've seen federal per pupil expenditures more than double since the 1970s. We spent about $2 trillion in taxpayer money through Washington since the 1950s, and yet we've seen nothing in terms of academic improvement. So, you know, it's unfortunate, it's expected, but unfortunate that we didn't see the president tack a whole nother ideological stance on this and say, you know what, instead of doing what the special education unions, the special education interest groups, the unions want to do, we're actually going to try something that's in the best interest of kids and not necessarily in the best interest of adults.
Mm-hmm. If you could name one state or city that would be a model for school choice initiatives, which would it be?
Well, that's a great question. Louisiana, New Orleans in particular, has the most market-based education system in the country right now. About 100% of students are in either charter schools or schools of choice, private schools. So that's certainly one to look at. And I think people should keep an eye on Louisiana over the next year to see what they end up doing, if they end up taking that model statewide. But, you know, Florida has always been a leader on the school reform issue in general, not just choice. But, you know, under Governor Jeb Bush in 1999, they started this whole set of sweeping ed reforms. So grading schools on an A through F scale based on student performance, high state standards, alternative teacher certification, merit pay for teachers. And, of course, all of those reforms were tied to school choice to actually provide some teeth to the other reforms. So in Florida, I mean, it's amazing when you consider the fact that Hispanic students in Florida now outpace or tie the statewide reading average of all children in 31 states. And that was not the case before Governor Bush's reforms went into place. So Florida's always been a leader on that, but I think we're seeing states like Arizona take the lead on ed savings accounts, Louisiana. So there's a good crop coming up.
Last question. In contrast, what do you know about school choice efforts in Virginia?
Unfortunately, you know, it's sad. I'm a native Virginian, and you would think of any state, Virginia could get this done. It's not that difficult, and we haven't been able to do it. Year after year, we just haven't seen it, and the proposals we have seen have been pretty weak proposals, quite frankly. There is an effort underway right now to perhaps create a tuition tax credit program. Unfortunately, it's not a push for a universal tuition tax credit program. You have a program that's being pushed that would provide corporate tax credits, which are fantastic, but would help low-income children by providing them scholarships. If Virginia really wanted to be a leader, they would couple that with personal use tax credits, allow middle-income families to get credits, and create a universal program. So we'll see if that comes to fruition. But, you know, at least Virginia's starting to itch a little bit about it and lift caps on charter schools and do some online learning. So they're moving in the right direction, but they could really use a boost in a solid school choice program.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. We'll be back next week with one more interview from the Virginia Film Festival that we couldn't fit in today. In the meantime, for all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Come back soon for more news, reviews, and interviews. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.